KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
I'm Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business, and this is the latest installment of our monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff. Now here's host Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider, and this is The Spinoff. We have Joe Adalian of Vulture.com joining us from KUNV in Las Vegas. Hey, Joe.
Howdy, Michael.
And AJ Marischal of Variety here with me at the KCRW mothership.
You look great, Michael.
Oh, thanks, AJ. And welcome to the February edition of The Spinoff, where Joe, AJ, and I gab about the evolving TV business and what keeps most executives and producers and writers up at night. This month, the Winter Olympics are going to dominate the Nielsen ratings, but the hot topic actually is going to revolve around what happens at 11:35 p.m. It's another edition of the late night wars as NBC undergoes yet another transition in that day part. And this time they hope it's a little smoother than last time. It's also that time of year when shows that are straddling between renewal and cancellation give it one last shot at securing another season on the air. So those are the hot topics this month: late night, the Olympics, and bubble TV. So let's kick things off with late night, guys. So on Thursday, February 6th, Jay Leno is set to say his farewells on NBC's The Tonight Show. Then Jimmy Fallon takes over on February 17th. Will Smith and U2 are his first guests. And also, that means with Fallon leaving Late Night, Seth Meyers is taking over the renamed Late Night with Seth Meyers, which premieres on February 24. So a lot of questions out there. A, will Fallon succeed? But B, is Leno really, actually, honestly going to take a break like he says he's going to? And really, does this even matter anymore? Joe, does this matter anymore? Are people still watching Late Night?
Well, people are watching TV in Late Night. Are they watching Late Night TV? I mean, numbers for the broadcast network shows are all down over the past 5 years, like everything else in network TV. The competition from cable just continues to snap away audience. You've got competition from network primetime. You know, networks are now competing with themselves because people have all sorts of shows saved on their DVRs, and they can just watch that at 11:35. And then, of course, there's the internet, and of course, there's Netflix, and of course, there's Hulu. That said, you know, a decent number of people still watch late night TV, you know, a couple million for each of the network shows. And, you know, there's absolutely too much made of this, but oh well, you know, we make too much of everything in our society, so why not late night?
Right. And part of what why we make such a big deal about it is what happened, A, in 1992 when, you know, David Letterman and Jay Leno first battled it out for the Johnny Carson crown. And then, of course, what happened recently in 2010 when Conan O'Brien took over The Tonight Show. And, of course, we all remember what happened there with the ratings and with NBC trying to force Jay Leno back to 11:35, which then kicked Conan to the curb and et cetera, et cetera. AJ, do you even watch late night TV?
I do not watch late night television when it comes to those broadcast network talk shows. I do watch The Daily Show and Colbert Report from time to time, but oftentimes on a rebroadcast the next day or via DVR. I definitely agree with Joe. This is a time when you can be catching up on a TV show again that Joe said you've DVR'd, or you could be streaming your favorite Netflix show, or you could be watching something on YouTube or engaging with social media. The content that is available to you at the 11:35 hour is vast now, and that's taking people away from the late night space. And people who are in my 20-something demographic, we often are not watching, you know, these late night shows anymore. Even the younger skewing ones like Kimmel. I don't know anybody off the top of my head in my age bracket who tells me that they are religiously watching late night.
Well, what they're doing is they're watching the clips.
Right.
They're
exactly.
Watching the clips
that's
on YouTube.
That's the thing
about
late night also is that the way that people are consuming this kind of content, whether it's like sketch comedy for SNL, that's taking off in the YouTube space. I argue that the whole idea of a monologue of what happened over the day or the day before, that that's panning out on Twitter from these comedians all day long.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Jay Leno in the round of interviews he did with a lot of reporters, including Mr. Schneider over there, you know, he talked about the advice that he gave to Jimmy Fallon. He said, you got to make the monologue longer, you know, double the length of the monologue. That's what America wants. And okay, maybe some of the older viewers who were watching The Tonight Show still, that's what people crave. I would argue that, you know, the monologue is less and less important. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel, you know, has been modifying what a monologue is since almost the day he got there. You know, it's filled with all sorts of small pre-taped bits. There are still a few jokes about the day's events. But, you know, I'd like to see the Tonight Show host, you know, maybe even eventually think of giving up the monologue or moving into a different part of the night, you know. And I think maybe Fallon will experiment with this. You know, he should lead with what he does best, which is performances, whether they're pre-taped sketches or whether it's a live thing, whether it's a bit with the audience, whatever it is. I think the more that Fallon makes that show about creating interesting content and moments as opposed to just regurgitating the day's events, the better off we'll be. It's sort of like, you know, the newscasts. I mean, you know, there are very few package reports in a lot of newscasts now because it's all about, you know, talking heads. And even though there's too much of that, it's still good to offer something you can't get on the internet.
And well, you mentioned Leno and the advice that he gave. I mean, let's you know, tip our hat to Mr. Leno. He was number one for most of the last 20 years and never really has gotten his due from either the critics or from the awards. But, you know, and I've gone back and forth through the years on what I think about Leno. But honestly, you know, as he comes to the end of this run, you do have to admire the fact that he managed to keep this show number one for all those years.
Well, not all those years, Mike. I mean, the fact is it was not number one when David Letterman was hot. NBC, you know, had a lot of ratings advantage through a big chunk of that and historical advantage. The Tonight Show has a lot of historical advantages. I mean, yes, he's number one. But what does number one even mean these days?
Well, it means less than it used to, but that still means something, even if
sure.
It's just sort of a victory lap.
Yeah.
You know, but you're not a Leno fan. Is
well,
that what
no, I'm a fan of Jay Leno the person. Every time I've met him, he's been nothing but nice to me. I've interviewed him several times when he was going through some changes. He would get on the phone with me during the strike. He talked to me. You know, I Leno's a very good guy, and you're right. It's something to be said for being number one for 20 years. Most of that, I guess. I mean, you know, but I at the end of the day, I you know, what is the legacy going to be? You know, is he beloved by anybody? I would argue no, and that's fine. You know, Jay Leno's biggest reward is the giant paycheck he got.
He does have some nice cars,
and nice cars, and having a nice life, and you know, and having a lot of fun. And God bless him.
I
mean, we can all read too much into this.
And I do think he is beloved by you know, several million viewers who do tune in. And you know, again, the middle America argument that, you know, we do have to mention that there is just a chunk of middle America that, you know, maybe finds him, you know, preferable to the hipper
and younger
choices.
It's the silent part of America that isn't nestled up against an ocean that is, you know, a huge part of late night viewership. For me, when I watched Leno, I liked some of his bits, but when it came to his monologue, I didn't connect with it. It was really broad. The jokes were kind of tame, and I preferred edgier dialogue, and that was why I was tuning into, you know, Comedy Central for Daily Show with Jon Stewart, or why I wanted to start watching Kimmel when I was up at that hour. I kind of go to bed early, so I like to DVR things. I would like to disagree, though, with Joe when he says, you know, that Fallon should focus on doing sort of more like shticks and interesting sketches and bits. Because that, to me, is the kind of stuff that's going to be hot online afterwards, and you're not going to be incentivizing viewers to be tuning in. One of the reasons why people tune into The Daily Show at 11 o'clock is because they are interested in what Jon Stewart has to say as somebody who's satirizing the news, and it's very relevant. And again, that you're attached to a person and not a shtick that's going to be online on YouTube next day.
I'm not saying I think you have to keep it topical and you have to make it tied to the personality. But the thing is, what Jon Stewart does is very carefully scripted. Half of that stuff at the top of the hour or the top of the show is stuff he does with correspondents, which are bits basically. And the other part is one or two topics. You know, that doesn't mean let them evolve the monologue. I think Stewart actually is ahead of the curve, and so is Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy Kimmel's monologue is not the standard monologue. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of different bits. It has a lot of different videotape elements. I mean, he's been brilliant from the beginning at sort of being this observer of the giant media machine that we all watch. You know, he's constantly spoofing on the internet, bringing stuff that's viral on the internet onto TV, you know, bringing videos, newscasts around the country. So I think Fallon needs to find some way to reinvent the monologue as opposed to just doing one-off jokes.
The problem that you know, both Colbert and Jon Stewart did was they showed us that there's a different way to do late night, and these big broadcast network talk shows now feel a little stale. And you know, there's still the desk, there's still the monologue, there's still the band, there's still the guests, and you know, unfortunately, I feel like there was an opportunity here to do something different, and I'm not sure we're going to see anything different. You know, I'm holding out hope that maybe Seth Meyers does something different, but so far the sense I'm getting even from that show is it's still going to be a traditional
right
talk
when
show.
We and see by the set way, pictures, we'll be assured that it is the same show.
By the way, we need to clarify, too, when we say that Jay Leno is number one at the end, he's number one in terms of total viewers, and he's number one in adults under 50 among the three broadcast shows. But in terms of adults under 50 and adults under 35 in the whole universe, Jay Leno is not number one. Jon Stewart does bigger ratings. Stephen Colbert often does bigger ratings, not always. And Adult Swim often
and of
beats
course,
all of them.
We bring it, yeah, and Joe, you and I love talking about how Adult Swim, which is, of course, the late-night block of adult-oriented cartoons and animated shows, and some live-action stuff, too, on Cartoon Network, is really popular with young men, 18 to 34 and 18 to 24, usually beats everything else because it's so different and so edgy. And
it's a real sleeper draw.
Some really good stuff. So, again, it's just a reminder that late night is changing, and it's about to change once again. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Spinoff, the monthly TV podcast from KCRW's The Business. I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine, here with AJ Marischal of Variety and Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. So, okay, let's move on to our next topic. So, NBC Universal forked over $775 million for the media rights to the 2014 Sochi Olympics. But, according to at least one report, the company's going to rake in more than $1 billion in ad sales. So obviously the Olympics, it's still good business. AJ, do you watch the Olympics?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you love it?
My goal is to not cry during the opening ceremony because it makes me super emotional.
What do you think NBC gets out of it besides cold hard cash?
Well, if you remember, during the Summer Olympics, they were trying to sample a bunch of shows like Go On and the beloved Animal Practice.
Yeah.
And it didn't really turn out so well for those shows. You know, you're having viewers that are parachuting into these programs if they're trailing off at the end of maybe a swimming competition. Definitely a lot of people that parachute into NBC for the Olympics in general. What interests me is the Olympics in the digital age. During the Summer Olympics, people were up in arms when major publications like the Wall Street Journal, I think even the New York Times did this, CNN, they were tweeting out the results of these huge competitions while they were happening hours before they were going to be broadcast on NBC. So the Olympics, in terms of being a delayed broadcast from these foreign countries, they're really facing problems with how do you keep people tuning in to these, you know, these primetime broadcasts of, say, ice skating and other major events in the Winter Olympics when people can find out all the results online. And sometimes inadvertently, it's this definitely the spoiler alert culture of sports.
But nonetheless, it seems like the only thing that still works really well for the broadcasters is live TV. I mean, look at the Super Bowl.
111 million viewers.
Yeah, and that was not a good game, but
yeah.
People, you know, they wanted to be a part of that experience. They were on social media and they're riffing on
right.
It. They're riffing on Bruno Mars and everything else. So maybe there still is some value to.
I have a question about that. Maybe Joe. I know Joe. You were tweeting during the Super Bowl, as was I, and a lot of people were speculating that maybe the ratings would have taken a solid dip after the second half, during the second half rather of the Super Bowl, because it was such a blowout for the Seahawks. But the ratings actually were. It was the highest rated in history, if
yeah.
I'm not mistaken. But my question is, if we didn't have Twitter, would people be walking away from their TVs and turning it off? I think that there is a sense that people are continuing to stay
yeah.
tuned into these games so that they can engage on social media at this point, which is very interesting to
you
me.
Know, there's something to be said for that.
There's something to be said for that, perhaps. I think more people who are watching the Super Bowl yesterday were not tweeting than were. There's a Twitter bubble, I think, that we all get into. If you actually think the number of Americans who are actually on Twitter, it's relatively small. Most people are enjoying beer and hot wings.
Well, there were tens of millions of tweets at certain
there were tens, from 10 people, 10 of us. But, you know, I don't disagree. You know, I need to be a little bit of a truther here on Super Bowl ratings, and I think this will come into play with Olympic
yeah.
ratings as well. Yes, 200,000 more viewers watched this year's Super Bowl than last year's on average. There are also, over the last year, America's added over 2 million new people. Now, some of those are little babies. Some of those are immigrants. There are more people watching TV. If
right.
you just based it on the actual rating, it's flat, which is fine. It's
well,
certainly
it's, yeah,
a compliment.
Joe's accounting
course,
for population inflation.
Well, it's always going to grow. No,
you have to.
Grow.
It's well, you have to look at the rating. And Fox, of course, likes to, and all the networks love to put it out there. It's the same thing with box office gross. Every movie makes $100 million now. Well, not really, if you put it in inflation-adjusted figures. But the point is that absolutely, I do think Twitter absolutely helps, AJ. Your point is right. I think there's new ways to engage. There's new way for the party to be bigger. And I think historically, though, people people watch the Super Bowl for reasons far beyond the game. It is because of the ads. It is because
Lord
of the
knows I don't
show.
Know what's going on in that game. I'm only on Twitter.
So it's long ago since. Twitter certainly doesn't hurt. But I think with the Olympics, you know, part of it is also these numbers always look bigger because the pie is shrinking elsewhere. You know, NBC's Olympics ratings, I think, are going to be lower than most recent Olympics, but they'll still look big compared to what Community is doing on Thursday nights.
Well, and they'll cume the numbers as well because it's across many NBC Universal suites, MSNBC, USA Network, mm-hmm. CNBC, many networks. They also have their streaming coverage online. So, you know, there are many different ways to skin this cat. Now, my other big question, by the way, about the Super Bowl is 2.4 million people were instead watching a repeat of Little Fockers, the movie on NBC. Who are these 2.4 million people? Yeah, you know, Super
Broncos
Bowl.
Broncos fans.
Not for me, but Little Fockers, absolutely.
Broncos fans. They saw when the Seahawks passed the 21-point mark, they were just like, ooh, what else is going on a few channels down?
Guys, one more thing on the sports tip we should talk about is, you know, the other big topic right now is, you know, and the NFL is pondering selling a package of some of its Thursday night games, the games that have been on the NFL Network, to a broadcaster. Now, the broadcaster would likely share the coverage with the NFL Network, and it's only about 8 games. But nonetheless, the idea is, you know, the NFL continues to grow. It's the number one program, both on broadcast and cable, and here's another package. Joe, what do you make of that? I mean, at some point, is there such a thing as, guys, there's, you know, you're doing too much of a good thing, and you're crowding out your scripted, your traditional entertainment programming.
You know, I guess here's the thing. I think the secret for all of the broadcast networks going forward, and Fox is already way ahead of the game on this, is how to produce less first-run scripted programming through in-season and to spread that out, first of all, you know, over the summer and in shorter bursts. I think the problem is there's so much content out there everywhere else. I think networks need to find a way to make content that is – whenever possible, must-see content, really good content, and not just filler. So if having 8 weeks in which Thursday's filled by football instead of something else and allows you to maybe do some scripted programming in the summer, some more miniseries, okay. I don't know about the economics. It does seem like a lot of football. But Joe, let me ask you this.
When you say less first run, you mean just basically just less original programming, that maybe the networks are throwing too much stuff at us now?
I think there's too much just sort of stuff that's there to fill a time slot as opposed to actually be something that's of value. Yeah.
Well, maybe they should cancel more of their bubble shows, which brings us to our next topic. We'll take a short break now, but after the break, we'll talk about TV's bubbles. This is The Spinoff on KCRW.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're back on The Spinoff. I'm Michael Schneider, along with Joe Adalian and AJ Marischal. Now, it's getting to be that time of year, kids, as showrunners wrap up their seasons. And for some of those unlucky shows with low ratings, well, it's also that last-ditch effort time to try to squeeze out a few more viewers before the networks decide what's going to be renewed and what's going to be canceled. Yes, it is TV bubble time.
Quick! Get a good guest star.
And you know, we were just talking before the break about how even NBC is thinking about blowing up their Thursday night. Maybe they would put NFL football there. But they have a number of shows that are on the bubble, such as Sean Saves the World, and which was actually kind of just canceled, and Michael J. Fox Show, which had been picked up for a full season but never really took off in the ratings. But things are a lot different these days. We're looking at ratings differently, and more than ever, people are watching shows delayed, as we've talked about on past episodes of The Spinoff. And so it's become a little tougher to tell, okay, what shows should we pick up and renew, and what shouldn't we? The Mindy Project, that's a fine show. It's a very funny show, but it's doing nothing in the ratings on Fox. But it's an upscale show. There's a fan base. I don't know. What do you do if you're at Fox? Joe, you actually recently wrote a great story for Vulture.com about the bubble conundrum that the networks have.
Well, you know, it says that there is no bar anymore under which shows can't slip in order to get renewed, it seems. We saw that last year when NBC brought back Hannibal, whose same-day ratings were atrocious. But it brought it back because the show did very well, or did decently, when you added in DVR replays, and it had strong critical buzz. It looked good, and NBC executives liked it. Now, ultimately, will the show become a hit? Who knows? But I think that networks increasingly are finding that They can't fill every hole. They can't plug every little leak in their
right.
schedule.
You,
and there are a lot of
leaks. You can't cancel everything.
And since you – and you could be like ABC, which does cancel a lot of shows.
Well, because they now, pick up a lot of shows.
They pick up a lot of shows. They cancel a lot of shows. And as a result, they're now in fourth place. I think ABC has been the worst at that, and they've paid the price. NBC, on the other hand, has been a little more consistent. CBS sticks with shows too. You know, CBS shows on general do a lot better than any other network shows, but they have shows that don't do all that well either. Yet they come back because CBS knows relative to everything else, they could do a lot worse. Unless you really feel you've got the show or you've got a likelihood of improving your lot in that time slot the next season, a lot of times it makes sense to just stay stable. And but the biggest thing I'll say about Bubbles is I know nothing. And I, in doing my story on Bubbles, I sort of admitted that. It's like, this is sort of what I think could make sense, but I honestly have no clue because networks are having to look into a whole bunch of other things beyond ratings to decide whether or not a show is worth bringing back. For example, do they own it? Do they have a potential deal with overseas broadcasters to rake in millions of dollars towards the production cost of that show?
Right, which is why they brought back Hannibal, for example, big international show.
Exactly. So the thing is, you know, there are websites out there that will say, hey, we're going to tell you by the numbers exactly whether a show is worth bringing back. You cannot just look at numbers anymore and make an informed decision as to whether a show will be coming back. You know, Hannibal proves that. The Mindy Project last season proves that. You know, yeah, sometimes it's pretty obvious a show's not going to go anywhere because the numbers are so bad, but that's also most likely because the show isn't very good creatively, because the numbers are not trending in any way but down, and the network has no ownership in it. It's a combination of factors. So the Bubbles, who knows what's going to make them pop these days?
Yeah, and I hate to break the news to fans of shows, but those cute Save Our Show campaigns, you know, where they send a bottle of Tabasco sauce to network executives or cartons of peanuts.
Or a plane over TCA with a banner.
Those are the things that impact the decisions the least.
Yeah, stop leaving comments on the assets cancellation on my ABCVariety.com story. It's like 10 comments a day.
Even though I don't think you need to be setting Tabasco sauce in, I do disagree just a teeny tiny bit about that.
Okay.
Because I do think, I think viewer passion can make a difference in a close call, or at least it should.
Passion is coming in the form of social media these days,
right,
and intensive
exactly.
blog posts,
well,
not these
yes,
you know grassroots
yes.
efforts
your,
to send
and,
stuff.
Well,
your,
and as long
yes,
as that passion actually translates to seeing some sort of uptick, maybe in VOD, maybe in Live Plus 7, Live Plus 30, who knows? They just, you know, talking to someone at ABC the other day about the show Trophy Wife, which I think we all adore here. It's a great, funny
yeah.
show.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is they're not seeing any uptick. Even in Live Plus 7, and then they just want to see something, some sort of sign of life in order to save that show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but see, I think networks increasingly, smart networks will realize even if you don't see that life, which you didn't see that much of a life in Hannibal. I mean, I guess it certainly percentage-wise it did more because its raw numbers were so low. It looked like it was adding a lot of people with DVR. But I think networks also just have to decide is, do we like the show? You know what? Last year, Paul Lee brought back The Neighbors, a show that he really liked and he really believed in. There are a lot of people who say creatively that show has gotten a lot better. Do I think he should have brought back The Neighbors? Well, no, I don't watch The Neighbors. But you know what? It was probably better to bring back The Neighbors than to try yet another new show. Now, if I were running ABC, I would have brought back another Bubble show, Happy Endings, because that show to me is a much better show and potentially could be a bigger
but
hit.
But of course, Joe, let's not be naive. Which show did ABC own?
That was what I was going to say, Mike, is that he made a decision based upon the business. He owns one, he owns not. That's a sad reality. So I don't blame him for bringing back The Neighbors, even though, you know, it didn't have a lot of buzz. It's like, okay, it makes sense. Networks have to be patient. And I think they should err, in my opinion, on the side of what's best. And I do think ownership makes some difference, but I think actually networks would be wise to
I think we're seeing more of that, though. I mean, ABC, for example, did pick up Happy Endings, after its first season.
When it was airing, it was doing fine. And they just moved it around. They third rocked that thing, and it didn't work out so well.
All right, gang, now we're at that point in the show where we're going to go around the room and each of us will download the story that's top of mind this month. Let's kick it off with Joe. Joe, what are you thinking about this month?
Well, this month I'm particularly concerned with what's happening to MSNBC, a network which I really love and does some great quality journalism and TV. But lately they've become the Chris Christie network, and they've become devoted to all things Chris Christie crisis. Now, look. the Bridgegate scandal is something that could, in fact, bring down his administration. Who knows? By the time you're listening to this, there may not be a Governor Christie anymore. Probably unlikely. Nonetheless, MSNBC has treated this story, which at its heart is still a local story, like it's, Benghazi. And while it's one thing for Fox News Channel to devote to one story like a dog with a bone and bury it into the ground and forget about all sense of balance, it's depressing to me when the day after the State of the Union, MSNBC is still mostly talking about the state of New Jersey. It's not a national story yet. Yes, I realize that Chris Christie is a potential candidate for 2016, but it's still only 2014. He has never announced. I don't care that much about it. They need to have more perspective. It may be great for the ratings. It's not great for MSNBC's overall reputation. They need to cool it with Christie.
All right, Joe. AJ, what are you thinking about this month?
Well, I just got back from Real Screen Summit in D.C., which is a huge reality television confab where buyers and sellers, otherwise known as producers and networks, will meet to hash out deals for new reality shows, and a lot of partying goes down. And one of the really big topics there was the issue of format rights with cable networks and how essentially these cable networks, whether it be A&E, History Channel, the entire Scripps family that is particularly notorious with this, the HGTVs and DIY networks of the world, they are tying up the format rights for these reality TV shows so that these production companies cannot shop them internationally and really turn a profit. And so what's very interesting to me is that even though we're in the age of, you know, the Duck Dynasty, Real World is still doing okay on MTV. You have the shows, the Voice and whatnot, these big reality shows. It's still hard to turn a profit in the reality TV space. And I had major producers and heads of production companies coming up to me and saying, I'm basically just working for a paycheck. I'm not able to actually get some bang for my buck out there. And it's because these cable networks are tying up the rights to everything. One of the solutions to that a lot of these people are doing is they are selling their shows internationally before they take them stateside so that they can maintain their format rights. But ultimately, there's a question out there of, is this going to suffocate the reality TV ecosystem? If you don't let these producers take these shows and maintain the rights so that they can have extra profit on them, you may see production companies in the reality space folding because they can't keep the lights on.
Yeah, you got to have either a big star or a just fantastic format in order to make it these days, it seems. Well, let me talk about, I don't mean to bring things down, but one thing I wanted to bring up before the end of the show that I've been thinking about this week, the sad, sad story of Philip Seymour Hoffman, who passed away at the age of 46. All of us here in the room were at the Television Critics Association press tour a few weeks ago, and Showtime picked up a new show called Happy-ish, which looked fantastic. Philip Seymour Hoffman played a aging ad exec who just decides that, you know, I don't know if I can make it in this world of 20-somethings. The pressures of this job is getting to me. It looks like sort of a fresh, interesting take on
the
generational
out loud, yeah.
gaps. It looked fantastic, very funny. And, of course, it was a show that even the president of Showtime, David Nevins, said, we could not do this show without Philip Seymour Hoffman. They waited and waited, and they pursued him and pursued him. Such a great script and such a great idea for a show that he finally agreed. Philip Seymour Hoffman didn't do much television. His only main big credit was the HBO movie Empire Falls. But for the most part, you know, he had such a successful feature career that he didn't dabble much in TV. This was going to be a big deal. And honestly, all of us, after watching the clip that Showtime showed in the room, we turned to each other and said, well, just give him the Emmy now. But unfortunately, he had only shot that pilot episode. They were writing additional episodes as we speak. But with his passing, we're still not quite sure what happens to that show if it continues. Very sad story.
I hope that we get to see the pilot. It really did look amazing.
It looked amazing. And I'll leave you with this. The creator of Happy-ish, Shalom Auslander, sent out a statement, which was, this planet is no damn place to have a heart. And Phil had the biggest, brokenest heart of anyone I've ever met. He was a beautiful person in a hideous world. Great actor, too. Yeah, such a shame. Passed away at the age of 46. I'm Mike Schneider, the Los Angeles Bureau Chief of TV Guide Magazine, and my Twitter handle is at Franklin Avenue, and I'm here, as always, with Joe Adalian, the West Coast editor for Vulture.com, and he tweets at TV Mojo, and of course, AJ Marischal, who covers television for Variety, and you can follow her on Twitter at Variety_AJM. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Mike.
And thanks, AJ.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of The Spinoff, the TV podcast from KCRW's The Business. This episode and all episodes of KCRW's The Business is produced by Darby Maloney. Melissa Morton is our technical director. And special thanks to the good people at KUNV in Las Vegas. You can find this and other episodes of The Business on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. You can also listen to us online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. And that's it for our TV party. We'll see you next month.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.